This hour, as we continue chatting with author Jack Carr, The Devil's Hand, we'll take your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Jack Carr with us. Jack, it took 10 years to find and kill Osama bin Laden. 10 years. What do you think took them so long?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that when someone's hiding, the manhunting part of it, like we're pretty good at it, but they're also, it just takes a while, it seems, depending on a host of factors. So I couldn't tell you exactly one thing, but I think we probably missed our window right off the bat. And then from there, it's those rewards for justice programs. Sometimes they work. They're fantastic. And other times money doesn't mean the same things to people around the world that it means to us. So just dropping a $20 million or $25 million, whatever it might have been, it doesn't have the same value over in other parts of the world that it does to us. So we get a little smarter about that sort of thing some of the time.
He was probably in Afghanistan when we went in there in October of 2001, but he probably just got away, huh?
I think so. There's an interesting book, Kill Bin Laden by Dalton Fury, talks about that and some strange events that occurred around one of the battles in the outset of the war there. And I think he had a couple ideas of why things stalled out for a while. But it's been a while since I read that book as well. But, yeah, interesting stuff.
Well, his second in command, as you mentioned, Aiwa al-Zahiri, it's been 20 years. We can't find him. Where the heck is this guy?
That's right. You know, we can look to the right and the left of Afghanistan, look into Iran, and look into Pakistan, and I would venture that he is in one of those two countries.
If he had died, do you think we would have heard about it?
Eventually. I mean, not right away, but you know, we have a pretty solid intelligence apparatus around the world, and I think eventually we would find out. But a lot of times you think these guys go off the radar for quite some time, and it becomes one of those things that, hey, we think they hadn't talked in a while, and so we think he's probably dead. Then, boom, all of a sudden the videotape appears. So without seeing the body, it's always best to assume that these guys are still breathing.
Well, with Jack Carr, his latest book, The Devil's Hand, his website, officialjackcarr.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He has got a series coming out next year called The Terminal List that Amazon Prime will play. And, of course, who knows? Your other books may be optioned as well, I bet, Jack.
Yeah, we shall see. See how this first one does. And if it doesn't do very well, then probably nothing else is coming. And if it does, then we can probably expect to see another season or something like that. We shall see. Fingers crossed.
Well, if just our listeners watched, you've got a hit. So
awesome.
Let's.
I love it.
We'll just make sure that when it's time for airing, you pop back on and talk a little bit about
Thanks.
That. And good for you. Let's go to the phones. Let's start with Joe in Long Island, New York. Go ahead, Joseph.
Jack, a two-part question about the writing. First of all, when you create a character, The Devil's Hand, does the person or the character stay in character? Or do they go outside the character in a sense like, I think I saw a movie, a librarian blew up half the world. Now that's going out of character. And my second question would be, you know, with all the responsibilities and threats when you're in a place like Iraq, does your imagination go dormant at that point? Isn't there enough to fill your mind without trying to, you know, where the creative writing part of yourself is kind of hindered?
Yeah, I'll take both those. So I'll take the first one. But my characters, when I start, I have a name and a position. So unless they're a recurring character, I don't really know them yet. I know that their name is what it is, and they're the president of the United States, or their name is what it is, and they're the head of a terrorist organization, or whatever it might be. But then I get to know those characters as I'm writing the dialogue. That's where I've found I really get to know those characters through their interaction with other characters, and they come alive through that dialogue. So so that's one. And then two, really what I'm doing as a writer and what I did on the battlefield are similar in that I'm aggressively solving problems. Now I'm doing it on the written page. I'm also doing it on the business side of the house. And if I mess up on either one of those, the results of that, those decisions are a lot less dire the consequences of those decisions and mistakes are a lot less dire than they were on the battlefield. But that's what I'm doing. Downrange in Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm aggressively solving problems. I'm adapting to the enemy. I'm looking for gaps in the enemy's defenses. I'm looking to capitalize on momentum. And the enemy's doing a lot of that to me as well. So I think being a creative problem solver, an aggressive creative problem solver, is really what I did on the battlefield and what I'm continuing to do today.
One of the problems over there, I would guess, Jack, is because they just filter in with everybody. I mean, they're all wearing the same kind of outfits and clothes and everything else. They didn't have military uniforms. How do you distinguish who's who?
That's it. The ones shooting at you, you want to shoot them. And then, of course, working the intelligence side of the house. And we figured out very early on that we couldn't just take one. A single source intelligence was very dangerous, because whoever was giving us that intel is someone who might be looking to exploit our lack of knowledge in an area.
That's right.
To settle some centuries-old feud. So what you need to do is have two totally separate human intelligence networks, and then you need to corroborate whatever you get from both of those through technical means, just to make sure that you're going after the right person for the right reasons. So we got pretty good at that over the years.
And we've got about, what, 2,500 troops still in Afghanistan?
Something like that. That's what I heard, yep. And with the date of September 11th, which is an interesting date to choose, because regardless of the date you choose, the enemy is going to claim victory, of course. And early on in Afghanistan, there was a saying, and it holds true today, and it said, the Americans have all the watches, but we have all the time. And I heard that, you know, almost 20 years ago. And that certainly holds true. But picking that date, and dates are significant, so to pick that one to come home, it seems to benefit the enemy more than it does us.
We got Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia with us now. Hi, Michael.
Hello, George, and thank you so much for having Jack on.
Thank you.
I spoke to Jack a few days ago on another show. I'm very impressed with this man. His novel, The Devil's Hand. I'm not going to give anything away here, but this is a man that I believe is writing in the same genre as Jesus Christ when he dictated the book of Revelation. In other words, he is giving us warning by way of what prophecy really is in the intelligence community. We write scenarios, we call them war games, and we figure out how to respond to likely circumstances in a competitive world. Now, in 1992, the Clinton-Gore campaign didn't have its biggest donor in the form of a U.S. corporation, not in the form of a Hollywood mogul, not in the form of a U.S. union, but in the form of an Indonesian businessman who the CIA has confirmed was closely tied to Chinese intelligence, the Chinese Communist Intelligence Agencies. Now, here we are in 2020. We have the son of the sitting president closely tied with Chinese intelligence. We have Anthony Fauci closely tied with gain-of-function research engineered viruses in Wuhan, and we don't have anybody in the media making this connection, raising the warning, giving us the prophecy of what is likely to come down from this.
Well, what do you think of that, Jack?
Well, I'd like to do a little more research into the first part of that question. or that that statement, of course, and I'm going to go look up the 1992 scenario and information right after I'm off this call, because it does sound fascinating to me. Sounds like something I can weave into a future novel. Yeah, as far as, you know, gain-of-function research and all the rest of that, it's just so hard today to figure out who to trust. And you can
sure
usually
is.
Assume that you're being manipulated, that someone's trying to manipulate you, depending on your news source. And there's just so many more ways to do that today than in the past. In the past, let's say 50 years ago, if you wanted some good press or bad press on maybe a competitor, you had to own a journalist. You had to either buy that journalist or blackmail that journalist. Today, it can be done in so many different ways because there's so many more inputs rather than just that newspaper, that magazine, that 6 o'clock news feed. So there are a lot more ways that that we can be manipulated, that our feelings can be preyed upon, and there's so much more information about us individually out there in Silicon Valley that gives them the ability to manipulate us, whether it's for commercial purposes or others. So I think the main thing is that no matter what we're doing, no matter what we're studying, what we're reading, we have to assume that somebody out there on the other end is looking to manipulate us for some reason. And that's a good question to ask as you start studying anything.
Well, with Jack Carr, of course, talking about his latest work, The Devil's Hand, you've gotten some great response to this book, too, Jack. Talk show host Joe Rogan, who is a great talent, just loves that book.
He does. He's been fantastic. He read them all and was kind enough to have me on his show twice, and he is a fan, just as I am of him, because he has people on, has interesting conversations, spends 3 hours with them, sometimes longer. That podcast and shows like this are really some of the last places out there where you can get honest conversation in a way that is not intentionally divisive, meaning that if I say something right now that doesn't come off quite right, well, I can go back and say, hey, you know what I meant to say was this.
That's right.
Other than a one-sentence or two-sentence response to someone on Instagram or Twitter who's just looking to get outraged. So that's why these shows are so valuable.
And speaking of podcasts, how was your Danger Close doing?
Yeah, amazing. So, yeah, Danger Close, beyond the books. And that's the main reason I did it, is because I was getting so many questions that better lent themselves to discussion like this rather than that one-sentence response on some of these platforms that just are not the best place to talk about things that need a little more nuance, that are important to have that intonation in the voice, that body language, that sort of thing as you're discussing contentious issues. So the podcast is the place to do that, and one drops every week, every Wednesday.
Let's go to Carl in Boston, Mass. Hello, Carl. Welcome.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Hi, Jack. Have I got a story for you if you wanted to write it? Not really, but I was just saying I served 3 tours in Iraq. My first tour I did, I was a lead gunner on convoy security. And my second tour, we did rebuilding the community at Five Points. And we were giving them water and teaching them school. But I guess my question for you is, in Afghanistan, because I never went to Afghanistan. I was my third mission, third tour. I got caught up in a PSYOP in a war game, and I ended up getting chaptered out. And my question to you on Afghanistan is, were they doing the same sorts of things in Afghanistan as they were in Iraq before they got in the IPs? And as far as...
Oh, you're breaking up, Carl. We lost him. Were you able to catch any of that, Jack?
Yeah, breaking up a little bit there at the end. So I think the question was, were similar tactics employed in both Iraq and Afghanistan from the enemy side? And I will say, yes, distinctly different battlefields, but there are also a lot of similarities, and there are things that that we could have learned ahead of time by studying, and then also once on the ground there that could be shared between the two battle spaces. But really, I mean, we can go back centuries to find out that when you're doing counter-insurgency that is expeditionary in nature, meaning not on home soil, sometimes an enemy wants you to do that. They want to draw you out. They want to provoke you. Then once you get there, they want to intimidate you and protract the war out to exhaust you. And that really has been a recipe for victory for countries around the world that have drawn in other countries from that are doing expeditionary counterinsurgency. So it's that provoke, intimidate, protract, and exhaust strategy. And our enemy has learned it well and learned that it works certainly against a superpower.
In Iraq, Jack, how long is a tour of duty?
It depends on what your for us it was 6 months. Army was typically a year, but some of them, gosh, I remember there was a host of Army units that were at the year mark, and some of them had flown home already. They were almost headed to the airport to fly home, and I think they got extended for another four, if memory serves. So so some people spent well over a year there. But yeah, it depends on the service, but in the Navy it was typically 6 to 7 months.
Did you get your full 20 in?
I did. 20 to wake up, I like to say.
Good for you. Good for you. Let's go to Mimi in Midland, Texas. Hi, Mimi. Welcome.
Hi, George, and thank you.
You're
and
welcome.
And to your guest, congratulations on your success.
Oh, thank you.
What I'm thinking of is this place, Afghanistan, goes all the way back, problems with it, all the way back to Alexander the Great. My great-great-grandfather was noted for the Battle of Kandahar in the 1800s.
Wow.
What on earth? You've answered some of it, but what in the world is the draw of this place? Is it a stronghold? Is it a place that different countries want the land? It doesn't make a bit of sense to me.
Did they want to put a pipeline through that, Jack? I always heard that.
Right. There's a pipeline thing. There's lithium. In modern times, of course, it was really part of the great game, the struggle between East and West, Russia and Great Britain back in the day. So it was really a crossroads, the Silk Road. So that's what it was back then. And there was a great book by Peter Hopker called The Great Game that I recommend everybody who's interested in Afghanistan read. And it gives a great foundation. But you're right, today, really, it is, for us anyway, the reason we were told is that we're going in there because it is a sanctuary for terrorism. It was a place that al-Qaeda could plan, where they could train and they could send forth their trained-up terrorists to strike our country. So, once again, not as important today to have that physical space. Of course, we saw a lot of videos come out after September 11th that showed people training in Afghanistan. People went through Iran to get to Afghanistan to train, to include, I think, at least 8 of the 9/11 hijackers. So it was a place where those things happened. And will it go back to that? Possibly. Probably. But in the same way that it was before? Probably not, because it is not as important today to have that physical space. But I recommend The Great Game by Peter Hopkirk it's so well written as well. So it reads like a spy novel. So I recommend anybody interested in Afghanistan pick that book up.
You know, with Bin Laden hiding in Tora Bora in Afghanistan right after 9/11, we should have just taken out that mountain with a nuke and just be done with it. You know what?
I bet someone brought that up.
Yep. No troops, nothing. Just drop one, take out the mountain, and that's it.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if that wasn't on the board after September 11th.
All right, we're going to come back, Jack, in just a moment and take final phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. The COVID-19 bill that President Trump signed into law last year includes a 180-day deadline for disclosing UFOs to Congress. It's an amazing story. How that got tossed into that bill is unbelievable. But next hour, it's called UFO Briefing Book. James Lowe joins us to talk about all this. I'm looking forward to that. We'll be back in a moment with final phone calls with Jack Carr as we talk about his work, of course, The Devil's Hand. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Jack Carr with us. Our final segment, The Devil's Hand, is his book. It's a thriller. And, of course, he's got a television program that'll be out next year on Amazon Prime called The Terminal List. So make sure that you watch it. I'll let you know, of course, as we get close to that incredible date. One of the things you do, Jack, when you're not working your tail off, is you like to save animals in Africa. Tell me about that.
That's right. So I, for the second novel, I hadn't been to Mozambique, and that was going to be a very important part of True Believer. So even before I submitted that first novel to Simon & Schuster, I was on a plane headed for Mozambique so I could get some of that local flavor and weave it into the storyline. For the first one, I'd been to Iraq, I'd been to Afghanistan, I'd been to most of the places that I write about in that first novel. For the second one, I'd been to Morocco, I'd been to Ukraine, but I needed to go to Mozambique. So I went there, put boots on the ground, learned a lot about Chinese influence, mining operations, both legal and illegal. Everybody, it seemed, wanted to tell me the story of Mozambique and the politics, about the poaching. I got to see firsthand the evidence of some of that poaching. And then I went back to write, and I needed to do some more research for both finishing up the second novel and for the third one, Savage Son. So I went to South Africa and helped train up an anti-poaching unit down there who was switching over to Glocks and M4s. So I have some experience with those weapon systems. So I went out there to lend a little bit of a hand, and I learned so much from them, the best man trackers on Earth, and a lot of them are fairly senior now. So they had grown up tracking animals for food. They caught the tail end of the bush wars. They came back and did what we would call crime scene investigation. So they took that man-tracking ability from the bush and applied it to an urban environment, really getting into the psychology of the people they were tracking, getting into their heads, figuring out their next move, anticipating their next move. And then they kind of aged out of that. And they, a lot of them are now being hired up by these private entities as anti-poaching units. And they're protecting, in this case, some of the last rhino on Earth. So I got to go down there, and I certainly learned a lot more from them than they ever did from me. And I got to weave that into the storyline as well. But just a fascinating, those countries are fascinating, but also the problem of poaching is so interesting because so much of it goes to Asia. And these syndicates that move that illicit wildlife from Africa to Asia are very intricate, and there's a lot of money involved.
Have you heard what they're doing in Botswana down in the southern Africa? They are selling licenses to hunt elephants.
Okay, yeah, I'll have to look into it because I don't know exactly.
It'll drive you crazy, Jack, when you find out. There's for $18,000, they're selling licenses to people so they can go hunt elephants. Apparently, they have 150,000 wild elephants down there. And they want them eradicated. It's crazy.
Well, there's definitely something to going and looking at the problem firsthand, because a lot of times what sounds good from the United States is a little different once we get on the ground and look at it through the eyes of somebody whose crops are getting trampled or starving elephants. I mean, who knows? But I need to look into that one a little more.
Let's go to the final calls, Don in Kent, Ohio, to get us started. Hey, Donald, welcome.
Hey, God bless you, George, and brother Jack. I really appreciate your guys' military service, your patriotism, and that. You know, I'm kind of concerned about what Putin, Russia's leader, is doing in the Ukraine. He's pushing the envelope, but he's also modernizing his nuke force, and we're operating with a 50-year-old nuke force. But what's troubling is I see on the horizon, you know, you mentioned, Iran and that. Now, there's a dual application in the Old Testament book of Daniel where an army from the west will attack the he-goat. Now, this army does not touch the ground, and it covers the whole earth. Now, Alexander the Great fulfilled the first part of the prophecy when he invaded, but, of course, he had an infantry unit that was probably no longer of a column than 50 or probably 100 meters wide or so. But are we about to fulfill this end-time prophecy? What say you?
This is one of those ones I'm going to have to do a little more research into. But certainly we're not doing a very good job of looking at actual threats these days. Even our military is being politicized, being used as a divisive force. And it used to be one of those things that that everybody could look up to or count on, I guess is a better way to put it. You could count on law enforcement. You could count on the military. And one other thing that we could count on as Americans was each one of us would stand up for someone else's right to say something, regardless if we, especially if we disagreed with them. That is what bound us together, and that seems to be not the case anymore. So regardless how we felt about other freedoms guaranteed guaranteed by the Constitution. That First Amendment was something that we could all rally around, and even companies acted in the spirit of that First Amendment. And I don't see that really happening today either. But point being, we are focused inward. We're tearing ourselves apart from the inside out, and that gives people like Putin an advantage, and they can exploit those divisions. They can stoke the coals of those divisions while they focus on building up things that are going to be advantageous to them in a confrontation. So we're certainly not doing ourselves any favors.
Jack, in Iraq, how many of our troops said, "What weapons of mass destruction?"
Well, yeah, that was we certainly looked, and I do have to believe that that our intelligence services and our senior level officials, as hard of a time as I give them, I think rightly so, for some of the decisions they made. I do tend to believe that they acted on the best information that they had available, and they did what they thought was right. And
they may have been led astray. That's possible.
They may have been led astray. This is very true. This is very true. And it also shows the importance of what we talked about earlier, of multiple human networks that are disassociated in nature. So you can't get fooled like that, or it's harder to fool you because you have these different human networks. And if something is suspicious, you get a third in there, maybe even a fourth. And then once again, you corroborate that with our technical means, things that we didn't have available to us 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago. So it's all about using those technical and tactical advantages. And we didn't do that in the outset to going into Iraq, that's for sure.
Let's go to Brian, state of Washington. Hi, Brian. Welcome.
Hello. It's always such a blessing to be on this show.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, Jack. And one little quick statement and really quick question. My father was in the Korean conflict, and he came a couple days after Elvis Presley donated a jukebox to the mess hall where they were at there. And my question is, Jack, when you go into, say, other countries, I was just curious about a time frame of, okay, we're going to get this mission done. Do they say, years, months, and I'll just go off there after that?
All right. We never had an exit plan, Jack, did we?
No, I mean, there wasn't a timeline attached to it that I remember anyway to any of these things. And I do remember the expectation being set that, hey, Afghanistan's going to be a while. And then what happens by that December, that January, here we are in Kabul, much to most of the world's and most of the talking heads' surprise. It's from there where we really, we snatched defeat from the jaws of victory after that point. But I don't remember a timeline ever being attached. And when we look at long-term expeditionary counterinsurgency, you're talking about a 30, 40-year campaign. And that's if you make wise decisions along the way, which we did not.
We've got James in Phoenix, Arizona now. Hi, James. Thank you for calling.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking the call.
You there?
Yes. You hear me?
Yeah, there you are. Okay, good.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is, I was there twice. I was there in 2009, 2010.
Thank you.
And just recently. Thank you. And in 2009, 2010, there was a lot of moving pieces. We were really busy and active. But of recent, very little movement. And I can even say we were closing down Kandahar, and we were moving to a different location. And I didn't understand why. So my question is, what are we really doing there right now? It's so quiet, and it's not like what it was before. What is the mission there now?
That's a good question, Jack. What's happening there?
Yeah, that is a very good question, and I don't think most of the American public can answer it. And I don't know the answer either. But what I would suspect we are doing is continuing to build up host nation force capability and capacity. With 2,500 troops, that's really that's probably what your mission is over there. So building up those host nation forces, possibly going out with those Horse Nation forces to do some direct action type missions. But when there's a date on the wall that you're leaving, a lot of that, what you're doing now is you're prepping to get out of there. You're figuring out what's going to happen with a lot of that equipment that you have over there, who is going to get turned over to. You're doing that war gaming of, hey, worst case scenario, if this stuff falls into the to enemy hands, you know, how can it be used against us? So what should we take home? What should we leave behind? What are the capabilities of these forces? And who do we continue to keep on the payroll at various different levels? Because you have to look 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years down the line and figure out, hey, which of these junior enlisted, junior officer are going to work their way up the chain that we still need to have on the U.S. payroll from an intelligence standpoint. So I'm sure, I would guess, that that's going on right now as well.
We've had 20,000 military folks wounded. We've had 2,400 have died. Just us, the United States, and as far as the Afghans, the Taliban have 72,000 people killed, Al-Qaeda, 2,000 killed, ISIS, 2,400 killed, civilians, almost 40,000 killed in Afghanistan, Jack.
Yeah, that's quite the 20 years we're coming up on right now. So it's that's been quite an investment.
Barbara, Lakeland, Florida. Hey, Barb, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Jack, I wanted to ask you regarding two aspects of 9/11. I found the information from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth to be rather profound, and I'm wondering if you have included that in your research and what you think about it. And then my second question is on the official report of the death of Osama bin Laden. Have you ever questioned that, especially considering that all of the men that were involved in that mission died in an accident? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I'll take the second one first. It was a different group that was killed less than a, or just over a year later. Or let's see, no, less than a year later. No, I have not questioned the official report because I happen to know quite a few of the people that were there and involved. But the other one, your first question, I didn't look into any of the structural side of things for this novel. It was mostly based on, the research was based on the people involved, not necessarily structure of the buildings.
Those people involved, too, they were driving around the country right before 9/11, weren't they?
That's right. And two of them made a visit up to Portland, Maine. And no one's been able to figure out exactly why they did that. Most people think that it's because they thought that there would be less security up there and they wouldn't have to go through security at in Boston again, which they did have to do. So there's not really a good question there, and I explore that a little further in the book as well.
Jesus in California. Jesus, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you, George, for having a wonderful guest, and thank you for the team. Jack, I want to give you the utmost thank you for all your service and what you did for our country and what you're still doing. My question is, I was always fantasized about the snipers when I saw Kevin Costner in Solvia with the war that was going on there. And I can only imagine what you've experienced and lived vicariously through some of your whatever. And I just want to know, what makes you tick, brother?
What makes you tick, Jack?
Well, I think it was I just wanted to serve my country. And wanting to do so at a level where people had served since the beginning of time, that ground combat type operations, and I was drawn towards special operations. So I wanted to test myself and serve my country. So when you combine both those things together, you look at, if I'm going to test myself, I should probably be looking at special operations, especially if you want to test yourself in that ground combat level. And SEALs were one of the ones that, in my research, I found were to be some of the most elite special operators in the world, and the training some of the toughest ever devised by modern military. So when you want to test yourself and serve your country in that capacity. You're going Army Special Forces, you're going Navy SEALs, Air Force Pararescue, Marine MARSOC, or Raiders now. So it just draws, just draws people, I think, that want to test themselves and serve their country at the same time. So that's it's really never left me. And today it's all about my next mission in life is about taking care of my family, and my passion in life is writing these days. So I've combined the two in this next chapter in life.
Jack, once again, thank you for being on the show. Thank you for your service to our country and continued success, and we'll keep in touch, okay?
Thank you so much for having me on, and take care, and thanks for all you do for freedom.
Super. What a great guest indeed. Up next, UFOs on Coast to Coast.